I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 101 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today, and hopefully for the next 5 days, is Father David Mowry, the chaplain of the MXM community. Welcome back to the show, Father David.
I'm very happy to be back on the show. You know, after you jumped into the river ahead of me, I just felt obligated to jump in after you, to grab you and pull you up into this bridge house. So while we both shiver and warm up here, I suppose it's good to warm up in front of the podcast microphone to talk about a very warm-hearted movie.
Exactly. Well, I wanted to save you, and that was a way to do it. You know, what
save
better way
me.
To save you? Of course. Well, you know. I jumped in first, so isn't that what Clarence did? I mean, we'll get there, but
oh, does that happen in the movie too? Wow.
I guess you have to refresh your memory a little bit. Or not. Either way works. So minute 101 begins with Clarence beginning to explain his attire. And ends with Clarence just stating the obvious. So as you mentioned, the way things ended yesterday was that, you know, George was contemplating jumping off the bridge, and then someone else jumped off the bridge into the water or from above. You know, we're still debating where Clarence actually was. You know, was he above George at the time, or was he on the same level? Because the bridge, if you know, I don't think the bridge has that many levels that he could have been. I mean, it could be that he was just standing on the beams on top of the bridge or something like that.
But Potter didn't finance a big pork barrel bridge construction project with a multi-level lane with cars on one level and pedestrians on the lower level. You don't think he's capable of that?
I think that he's a penny pincher, and therefore he wouldn't do it for that reason.
Oh, that's true. Because
you know,
that
why
would be spending
why
money
spend so much money on that? Exactly. Why spend so much money on that? Why do you need to have something on the top layer? You know, mm-hmm. you want people to be able to get back and forth into what soon will be Pottersville, and that's it. You know, that's where you make your money. Not building a sturdy bridge. Or not building anything beyond a sturdy bridge. I'm assuming the bridge is fine. You know, the bridge isn't going to collapse, but, you know, it doesn't need to have all the bells and whistles on it. You know, I think that's Potter's perspective on these things.
Mm-hmm.
We could be wrong. You never know. But that's my guess. And I think it's an educated guess, knowing, you know, having seen what Potter has done over the last 100 minutes of this movie, wouldn't surprise me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly it was a surprise to see Clarence jump into the river ahead of George, and whatever level they started on, they're on the same level now, cold, wet, and shivering.
Yes. Yes. Well, the truth is, I don't know how wet Clarence is. George is wet. You know, Clarence seems to.
I mean, we'll test right off pretty quick. You're right.
That's right. We'll get through this. I mean, there's some very strange things that are happening in this minute. I mean, so I mean, basically, Clarence is talking to the toll booth guy, and you know, he starts off by saying, "I didn't have time to get some stylish underwear." So I mean, it's a very interesting comment to get from I guess in AS2. About the fact that you know, because the perception that many people have, myself included, maybe you also, that you know, if you're in heaven, you snap your fingers and you can do whatever you want, you know. So it's not as if he needed to have the same pair of undergarments that his little light or spark, you know, because this is basically the first time that we're seeing Clarence in this movie. Because beforehand, he's just something in nether space. You know, so
it's a funny joke. It to have an angel talking about his underwear.
Yes.
As someone coming from the Christian tradition, I appreciate the joke that is here. The understanding that the Christian tradition has about angels is such that they don't need underwear because angels are purely spiritual beings. And as you look in the accounts in, say, the visions of the prophets like Isaiah and Ezekiel in the Bible, or in the encounter that Joshua has before Jericho, there's a lot of hay made out of the appearance of the angel. They never get into their sartorial choices because they're doing more important things. And that's overall one of the jokes in the movie is about Clarence, you know, working up, as you mentioned, from AS2, and we'll get there in a future minute.
Yes.
But the idea that he was buried in this underwear, it speaks to kind of a common misperception in Western culture. That in the Christian understanding of heaven, that when we die, we become angels. Again, angels are purely spiritual beings. That's all they ever are. As human beings, we're body and spirit. So when we die, something has gone wrong. There's been a separation between body and spirit. And so for Clarence to not only be working his way up the angelic hierarchy as a former human, and also to have the whole question of underwear is, what it lacks in theological accuracy, it makes up for in a good sense of humor, because the interaction between Clarence and the bridge keeper is so good.
Yes, it really is. I mean, I completely agree with you. I mean, you know, me coming from a background in Judaism, so there are, you know, angels, as you mentioned many times in the Old Testament. I mean, the first encounter you have with angels is with Abraham, you know, where he meets three angels, and the idea there is that they're pretending to be humans in order to make him feel better, you know, because he has just you know, gone through a traumatic experience of his circumcision. But what it comes down to is that, you know, as you said, there's angels are not humans that have ascended to heaven after having passed away. You know, but that's the premise. This movie, the premise is that's what it, or at least an angel second class. That's what it is. You know, we don't know beyond that. I mean, we only meet three angels throughout this entire movie. We meet Clarence, and then we have two other beings named Joseph and Franklin, which you know, we pretty much figured out that Franklin is supposed to possibly be the idea of God, because it's you know, Franklin is Frank Capra, and
interesting.
And Joseph is Joe Cirillo, who is one of the main writers of this. I think that's his last name. One of the main writers. You know, so it's basically the director and the writer that are the ones taking care of everything in this universe. Which I guess from a movie perspective, that makes sense.
Yeah, from a very postmodern metatextual level is true. What an interesting bit of authorial insert.
It definitely is. Joe Swirling, that was his name. So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way to look at it. You know, that's one of the problems, you know, with when, you know, movies take a dramatic license with these type of things.
As always.
So we have to just go with the flow of what it is that they're trying to show us in this particular place. You know, and then Clarence continues talking after he mentions about his underwear, and says that my wife gave this to me on my last birthday. I passed away in it. So it's not only that he was buried in it, he actually died in these undergarments. So whatever happened to this clockmaker, I think it was about 200 and I think next week we talk about it. that he died like 246 years before or something like that. I'm trying to remember the exact number, but I mean, it doesn't matter. He died more than two centuries earlier. You know, we don't know how old Clarence was at the time. We don't know what happened to him. You know, we could try and guess, but the bottom line is that you know, Clarence died in his underwear,
If he
or died
did
wearing his
die,
underwear. Sorry, he died wearing his underwear.
yeah, he died in bed and fully clothed, which I suppose is good. I wouldn't want to imagine Clarence otherwise.
Yes.
It's fascinating
As
to
much as
me
I love
that.
Henry Travers, you're completely right.
And it's interesting that he died around the year 1700. So one, how many clockmakers were there around the year 1700? And then I guess the other question is, I would want Clarence to speak more with an Elizabethan accent, more capital letters in his speech, a few more thous and thys, a little bit more, oh, what ho, good chap, that kind of thing, as opposed to this more modern dialect. Because I think that could play into the strangeness of it, because I know there's some very gentle juxtaposition between the overall gentleness of his manner and what he's saying as being odd, but I think the strangeness of Clarence could be ratcheted up just a little bit, just a few more changes in speech patterns
Right.
would kind of help clarify that the fish out of water kind of aspect of it.
Correct. But in all fairness, I mean, he's had these 250 some odd years up in heaven to learn from others, which is what we're about to get into also. I mean, he then looks over and sees he has a book and he goes, "Oh, Tom Sawyer's drying out too." You know, we talked about this earlier that he was reading the book Tom Sawyer. And then he turns to George and goes, "You should read the new book Mark Twain is writing right now."
Which
Which again,
is a very charming idea.
yes,
Because
but
I like that, because I know
it
that
goes with
ancient.
what you were saying though, because it's the idea that okay, you know, according to the premise here, so whenever someone dies, they go to heaven and they become an angel, but then the angels can interact with one another. These deceased beings can interact with one another. And you know, Clarence, who I guess is has been there for over 200 years, is able to, you know, have conversations with Mark Twain and actually know what book he's now writing.
You know, if there's any human being who would pass on being an angel, I bet it would be Mark Twain. I think he would not want to bother with it. He would much rather write about the angels than be one and have that responsibility. I'm charmed by the idea of Mark Twain writing this new book. It says to me that there are people in heaven who aren't angels, and there's something charming in the idea that even after death, Mark Twain is still possessed of that creative spark, that desire to continue to write. And I like that, again, coming out of the Christian theological tradition, there's this pop there's a proper understanding of heaven as a place of fullness of life. The popular understanding sees it as, you know, fluffy clouds and harps and a very kind of static idea. But in heaven, in the Christian imagination, we are face to face with God, and we are most fully ourselves in that relationship. And so, of course, we would expect Mark Twain to still be creative, to still have something worth saying, either about the people that he's encountering, because, oh boy, there'd be a lot of interesting characters in heaven, to say nothing of the angels and the Almighty and all the rest of that. But that his life after death still is of a piece with his life on earth. And I wonder, is Mark Twain, I mean, the way that Clarence talks about it, is like, you should read the book Mark Twain is writing. That speaks to me of, you know, the old serialized novel, like how Dickens would write Great Expectations. So that means that there's a printing press and there's a magazine publisher in heaven that is putting out various chapters of Mark Twain's novel. And since he has all of eternity, I wonder if he'll ever finish it.
Correct. That it's just an ongoing novel. But I mean, you said before that it's interesting to think about the fact that Mark Twain is possibly not an angel, but just because he's writing a novel doesn't mean he's not an angel. You know, maybe Clarence in his spare time, you know, fixes clocks up in heaven. I don't know. You know, maybe everyone has, I guess you could say, their day job and their spiritual job. You know, Clarence is, I mean, this is it. We're not 100% sure if this is Clarence's first mission on Earth. It might
kind
be.
of seems that way.
It might
kind
be.
of framed that way. He's had other angelic responsibilities, and this is like his chance. His name has come up in the rotation. Like, oh, okay, well, this is Clarence's chance.
Yeah, even though that Joseph doesn't think very highly of him. You know, what does he say? He has the IQ of a rabbit. I think that's what he said.
And the faith of a child.
That's right. Correct. So he says, oh, Tom Sawyer's drying out too, which basically means that, first of all, we don't know how long they're sitting in this toll booth with the fire on there, but you would think that cloth would dry quicker than paper. But well, I get maybe because it's a, you know, the book is from heaven, so it's somewhat I don't know if magical is the right word to use for it, but you know, it's heavenly. It's heavenly, so therefore you're right, it's special paper that dries quicker. You know, I mean, Clarence's clothes also look like they're pretty dry too. You know, George is the one who looks like he's about to really get sick here. You know, have a cold.
George, well, there are lots of things wrong with George, of course, in this scene. But yeah, it is funny how dry Clarence is, which kind of gets, I think it's the movie's way of getting it, like, oh, Clarence isn't like the rest of us. So the water just kind of washes right off of him, and even his book, yeah, is drier. And again, the fact that he has Tom Sawyer's book. So kind of like, is there like a Walmart in heaven? Because Clarence didn't That's have right. time for underwear, but he had a copy of Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer. So, yes. what is the the consumer forward economy of heaven like, and what do they use for currency?
My assumption is that there's no need for currency. You just go into the heavenly Walmart and you say, I'm looking for a book of Tom Sawyer, and then you get it. You know, I think that's my perception of what it would be, but I don't know. It's
Karl Marx deserves his heaven too. You're right.
I'm not saying it from a communist view. I'm just saying there's no use for currency. It's not needed. Just like in Star Trek, there's no use for currency in the future. So, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you can you don't have to just look at it from a communist perspective. But thanks for painting it that way. Yes. and then the toll booth guy says to Clarence, how'd you happen to fall in? And he says, I didn't fall in. I jumped in to save George. And George gets out of his stupor and goes, you what? To save me? Well, I did, didn't I? You didn't go through with it, did you? Go through with what? So it's very interesting that George is somewhat denying that he might have been contemplating jumping off the bridge.
Well, of course, George knows that he was flirting with a major societal taboo.
Yes.
Even though he was seriously contemplating suicide, he knows that it's wrong. And now that he's out of the heat of the moment, he doesn't want to admit in front of other people that he was at such a point of desperation that he was contemplating killing himself.
Correct. Well, it's the idea that most of the time they say that in these type of circumstances, you know, people at a certain point somewhat regret it. So I guess George is like that also, you know, where he's saying to himself, okay, you know what? I jumped in to save Clarence and I'm fine. Clarence is fine. Now I have to figure out what I'm going to do to solve my problem, because what I was contemplating doing isn't necessarily something that would have been helpful to anybody.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic that the movie introduces, because on the one hand, it's introducing this idea that Clarence knows George well enough to know that he is at heart a charitable man. He is habituated to giving of himself, and Clarence and we, along with Clarence, have seen that over the last hour and a half of the movie up until everything falls apart in the last 10, 15 minutes or so. And Clarence knows that to break George out of his inward looking view, he has to present himself as someone in need. He knows that's going to prompt George to action and to move outside of himself to save him. However, the movie is subtle enough in its presentation of George's condition that one charitable act is not enough to break George of this desolation, this depression that he's in. It presents George as a complex enough figure that he can be wrestling with his failure, with his sense of shame, of letting everybody down, of making mistakes all the time, of not being worth all the people that are in his life, as he'll say later in the week here, later over these days. But he still can act for the good. And that's Clarence's door. That's heaven's way into the beginning of George's transformation.
Correct. I completely agree with you on that. I think that's the way they're setting this up, you know, so it fits in really well. And at this point, Clarence actually then says it. He says suicide. And then the toll booth guy jumps in and goes, you know, it's against the law to commit suicide around here.
And which Clarence, is always a funny legal reality, because the state is interested in having people stay alive because that's better for the community. And so it will legislate against suicide to discourage that kind of thing, just in case that works. But of course, very hard to punish someone who goes through with it. God help us.
Correct. And
one of those aspirational laws.
That's right. I mean, there are ways that they would punish, that they used to punish the body, you know, about where it can be buried and things like that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The ain't there's in the Christian tradition, the suicide was often buried at the crossroads. It was buried in unsanctified ground,
right?
Because there was an understanding of the severity of the act, and the evil nature of the act warranted that kind of exclusion, even from the honors and dignity afforded to the dead within the believing community. Correct. In the Catholic Church in the last 50, 60 years, there has been especially in dialogue with psychological science, there's been a change in the treatment of those who have killed themselves. There's a more compassionate understanding of the various psychological and mental health factors that can take away the person's culpability and cloud a person's judgment and present reasons for hope that when this person died, they were not doing so out of some sense of spitting in God's face or acting in a way that is contrary to the Christian understanding of life. And so there is hope yet that this person can be received into heaven.
Right.
And, you know, see what Mark Twain is writing, hopefully.
Correct.
If Mark Twain is there. I don't know. I hope
right.
so. Because I mean, I love St. Joan, and I would love to know that Mark Twain's writing another one like that.
He's writing something better, obviously. You know,
he gets a chance to talk with Joan. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, in Jewish tradition, it's a similar idea that, you know, that you're, you know, someone who commits suicide is not allowed to be buried in the same place as everyone else. But like you said, over the last few decades, they've also come to the realization that, you know, the loophole, I guess you can say, of the psychological aspects of it, by saying that the person wasn't necessarily in their right mind at the time. So therefore, as you said, it wasn't an act against God, you know, so therefore mm-hmm. they find ways to get around that also. And then Clarence has a great line back to the toll booth guy, and he goes, yeah, it's against the law where I come from, too. you know, so we don't really know what goes on in heaven, but I don't think people can commit suicide in heaven.
There's an interesting connection there between, you know, the laws of heaven and the laws on earth are supposed to match up. That wouldn't it be nice if we were able to set up society here on earth in a way that matched the laws in heaven? And that comes into contact with the Christian understanding of natural law, that there is a fundamental good ordering of society that comes out of a proper understanding of who we are as human beings in relationship with one another, with creation, with the Almighty, and that there is a good way to order society based around that. And so Clarence's, you know, slightly glib answer, but also with the simplicity of a child, that he's pointing to, you know, the wisdom of the earthly law is grounded in the divine law, the sense of the heavenly, that there is something amiss about taking one's own life, that is not aimed at the full flourishing of the human person. Something obviously has gone wrong if someone like George is contemplating that. And the solution that this movie presents is a very rehabilitating one. There's an alternate possibility for those who consider that there is no other option available to them but taking their own life.
Right. That's true. And I think they do a nice job of doing that with the way that they present it here. Mm-hmm. And then the Tollbooth guy looks at him and goes, well, where do you come from? And Clarence, I mean, again, he's simple-minded, but he's so truthful with everything that he says, because, you know, he just says to him, heaven. And I mean, the guy is sitting there getting ready to spit into his spittoon a second time, because earlier in this minute he also did that, and he basically stops himself right before him, because he's taken aback by this type of answer. He wasn't really expecting Clarence to mention that he's actually from heaven, you know, with this whole thing. What do you know about spittoons? Do you know anything about that?
What do I know about spittoons?
Yes.
That I don't want to be anywhere near one. I had a college roommate who was a former butcher from Kentucky, and he and other fellows were in the habit of using chewing tobacco. And I don't think they would have the plug of tobacco like our bridge keeper friend here has, but, you know, they would have the cans of stuff. And boy, sometimes I wish we had a spittoon, because there was no nice brass bucket that would ring when you spit into it. Rather, they would just use old Coke bottles and or plastic soda bottles, and there would just be this unmentionable in the bottle after they were finished enjoying their tobacco. And it was quite off-putting. It reaffirmed my decision to not have anything to do with tobacco products, because it did nothing to present any sense of mystique or attraction about the habit to me.
Yeah. I mean, you see them often in Westerns, where they're just on the side and you don't really, they don't pay much attention to them. I think you had to wait until you saw Back to the Future 3 before they really started, you know, making people understand what a spittoon really is, because you get the gag in that movie where, you know, the spittoon, you know, falls on Buford Tannen, and then you see all the spit that's been accumulated there or anything like that. But during that time period in the 19th century, you know, in the late 1800s, so they were in so many different places. You had them in pubs, brothels, saloons, hotels, stores, banks, railway carriages, and anywhere that basically adult men gathered, in order for all these people who were chewing and, you know, they were using chewing or dripping or dipping tobacco. Do you know there's another name for it besides a spittoon?
No, I do not know the other name for a spittoon.
It's called a cuspidor.
Interesting.
Yes.
Because it comes from the mouth, like the cuspid,
yeah,
something. Mm-hmm. My dental Latin is a little hazy.
Yeah, it's actually Portuguese for a spitter. And it comes, as you said, from the verb cusper, which means to spit.
Well, there you have it.
That's right.
I guess Portugal had a lot of dipping tobacco and chewing tobacco usage.
And
I remember when I was growing up in the 90s, there were ashtrays everywhere. and the society had shifted, at least in the Midwest where I grew up. Society shifted from chewing and dipping tobacco to smoking, but there were still there was still an understanding of the need for that in public spaces. I remember the old trash cans that would have the trash can below and you have the ashtray on top.
Yeah.
Or mm-hmm. I went into my grandparents' house and there would be an ashtray next to where, you know, my grandpa would sit out on the patio. And it was just part of the background. So you wouldn't think of it. I only ever knew of spittoons from like Bugs Bunny spitting into one in a Looney Tunes short.
Okay, that's fair. That's definitely fair. And I mean, it was something that when I was reading about it, it's actually quite interesting that spittoons, they would usually have some sort of antiseptic in them because of for hygienic reasons. And when did people stop using spittoons? You have an idea of when they really started to be phasing out?
When would they stop? I'm going to guess... I'm going to guess 1920.
You are really, really close. If you go back 2 years to 1918, and do you remember what happened in 1918?
It was the end of World War One.
Yes, but there was also because of the, it was because of the Spanish flu epidemic.
Ah, the 1-2 punch.
That's right. The, yeah, you know, COVID, the prequel to COVID.
I don't like this movie franchise. I don't think we need any more sequels.
No, probably
that
not.
That makes a lot of sense. And not enough antiseptic for a Spanish flu-friendly spittoon.
That's right. That's right. And at that point, people started using chewing gum. So chewing gum became more popular than tobacco because I guess you didn't have to – you weren't drooling all over the place.
And that's what let Mr. Wrigley build his baseball field for the Chicago Cubs, my
there
own team.
There you go. Go Cubs. So, yeah, I mean, that's and do you know that most of us and most of the people listening still use a spittoon probably, let's say, about every 6 months or maybe once a year? You have any idea what else is called a spittoon that most people use?
I can't answer because I need to gargle and spit this mouthwash my dentist has given me.
That is correct. Very good. What we all have to spit into at the dentist office is also known as a spittoon or a cuspidor. So there you go. That very good. Kudos to you for getting that one.
This is proof to my mother that I am going to my dentist regularly. So
there you go.
Now, am I flossing? Well, that's for a different podcast.
Yes. I understand that. And at this point, it's really weird. Did you notice the music that starts playing in the background here?
It's Clarence's theme is Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, which right. I find very interesting because it's played on this celeste-like instrument. It's played on little tinkling bells or, you know, on the very high register of the piano, perhaps.
Right. I mean, it sounds like a music box, the way that it
does. Yeah. And I think it's interesting they're using Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star because, of course, we're introduced to Clarence as a star and we're introduced to Franklin and Joseph as kind of galactic blobs. So there's that celestial connection, but it's also a children's nursery rhyme. And so that speaks to Clarence's childlike faith and simplicity. And the musical sting backs up the simplicity of his answer as to his origin. So it fits together. The other thing that makes it stand out, of course, is just throughout most of these minutes we're talking about together, there's no music. And so that little piano motif shows up with all the more clarity.
Right. That's right. And then at this point, Clarence begins to continue telling, explaining the story. He goes, "I had that quickly. That's why I jumped in. I knew if I were drowning, you'd try to save me. You see, you did. And that's how I saved you." And George just looks at him and goes, "Oh, very funny." He's a non-believer at this point, obviously.
Yeah, well, and I think Clarence had the idea as he's watching George on the bridge, like, aha, this is my moment. I'm going to jump in, make George save me. He's going to see that life is worth living. Money's not the most important thing. Just with this one act, boom, easy peasy, 1, 2, 3, get my wings. All right. And I'll be home in time for dinner.
That's right.
And that's why he's saying with such confidence, "That's how I saved you. All right, brush my hands, dry off Tom Sawyer, back to heaven with me. Job well done.
He doesn't realize that he hasn't saved him yet. He's on his way.
He's becoming a parent.
That's right. Step one. Step one is of 52 steps or whatever it is. You know, he's still got a while to go. And then he comments to George and he goes, "Well, your lip's still bleeding, George." Which I don't really understand what the purpose of him saying that at this point is. Maybe just to remind us that George's lip was bleeding because, you know, later this week we'll get an understanding why that's more important. But within the context of this conversation, it doesn't make much sense for him to say this.
I agree. I think this is a writer putting this in to remind us about his lip.
Yeah. Because it has nothing to do with the fact that he saved him. He says, "Yeah, and I saved, you know, I saved you because you jumped in to save me. And by the way, your lip's still bleeding."
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't quite follow.
No, not at all. That's where this minute ends. So did you have anything else you wanted to say about this minute?
No, nothing else about this minute.
Okay. Very good. All right. So every Friday we have a segment called Oscar Oops, where the idea here is that over the last 96 years, many of us have seen most of the Oscar shows or read about them or whatever it is. And, a lot of times most movie fans have movies that they disagree, that they think, should have won awards instead of just being nominated. You know, they always say it's nice to just be nominated, but sometimes we all feel that something is more deserving. So the idea of this segment is for my guests to tell everyone the five Best Picture nominees that they think were undeservingly only nominated and didn't win. So obviously it has to be something that was nominated. So why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
All right. So I have ordered these. Yes, there are five of them. I wouldn't say they're any particular order of severity, but they are ordered chronologically. So we'll work from most recent snubs and back in time to the ones that at least jump out at me. So let me just say this. Of the movies that I'm going to talk about, most of the movies that did win Best Picture, I like. I think they were deserving of artistic merit and worthy of praise for taking bold creative choices and celebrating the craft of filmmaking. I just think there were some other ones that were better. So there are several good movies that came out in 2017. The Oscar winner for that particular season was Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. Now, I love del Toro. I think he's one of the most visionary directors that we have. His sense of scene setting and atmosphere is always so good. He has great use of lighting and cinematography. But I think the better movie that came out in 2017 was Get Out. As a directorial debut, as a social commentary, as a visual storytelling medium, I think there was so much more that Get Out did cinematically as an overall story. And I think over the last 6-7 years, I think Get Out has had more cultural and social staying power than The Shape of Water.
Yeah.
I think, and there's more that Get Out continues to say, especially to American culture, but I think Western culture more broadly, around race relations and using, I think there's also something to be said about the Academy being a little gun shy when it comes to honoring horror movies, because yes, there are a lot of bad horror movies. I get that. I don't much care for horror movies, but I think Get Out is one of those that has something worth saying, and also from a fresh creative director who is doing something new and exciting, and that's also worth an Oscar nod.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's 2017. Going back in time, like I said, I like most of these movies that actually did win. This is not one of those cases. The English Patient, I don't know. In 1996, that won Best Picture. I don't think that was the best movie that came out in the 1996 season. I think Fargo should have won. One, it's the Coen brothers. It's the Coen brothers at, how to put this, the Coen brothers at their most optimistic,
yes.
I guess we should say, because
yes.
there is a relatively happy ending at the end of Fargo. And, you know, it's Frances McDormand, who we all love. And, you know, she gave a great performance in that movie. And I think there's something about that kind of black comedy that, again, did a lot with the cinematography and the lighting, but it's the character study in particular. Whereas The English Patient, there were very heavy acting moments in that. The examination of evil in Fargo is really interesting because it presents this banality of evil. William H. Macy's character is just, you know, this kind of oatmeal of a person. there's not a lot to him. He's very bland, and yet he contemplates and sets in motion this horrific sequence of events. And it's matched by an equal ordinariness of goodness. There is not a superhero that comes in to save the day. It is a woman carrying a child whose husband is excited to win third place in the state stamp competition or something like that, where the stakes on both sides are life and death, but they are played out by very ordinary people. And I think there's a lot that's revealed about the human condition as a result. So I pick Fargo as my best picture in the 96 season.
Okay.
All right, then going further back in time, you may be noticing a theme in some of these movies that, you know, the Father David, he kind of likes the darker movies. You know, is he okay? Like, well, this next pick is not going to fix any of that, because in the 1979 season, Kramer versus Kramer won. But I think clearly the pick there was Apocalypse Now. Just as a piece of cinema, just the actual filmmaking of it, and it nearly drove Coppola insane.
Yes.
Just the amount of blood, sweat, and tears that went into it.
Have you seen Hearts of Darkness?
I have read Heart of Darkness.
Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, and the story it's based on, and so bring.
No. I'm talking about the documentary about the making of Apocalypse.
Oh, the documentary. No, I haven't seen the documentary.
I recommend that you check that out. It's
okay. Let me just.
It tells you a lot about what really went on during the course of filming that movie.
Yeah. So just for the fact that it exists at all, I think is really important.
Yep.
And then you have Sheen and Brando's performances in there, just as these really twisted character studies about the cost of war and what that does to a human person. And as a meditation on Vietnam as something that America continues to reckon with and come to terms with, I think was important cinematically. Now, of course, I'm not going to try and, you know, deny Meryl Streep any other Academy Awards, but I think cinematically Apocalypse Now should have gotten the best picture win that particular season. Okay, but there is a movie that is a crowd pleaser that I have on my list. It's not just all dark doom and gloom, because if anyone knows me, they know that I am a huge fan of one particular franchise. That's right, 1977. Look, Star Wars should have won best picture. Annie Hall is a very funny movie. It's got a lot of great jokes. The postmodern meta commentary in it is very funny. I think culturally speaking, Star Wars has had much more staying power, if not more positive influence than Woody Allen. Anyway,
probably. you're preaching to the crowd.
but Star Wars for the 77 best picture, just I think because it blew open a new era of cinema, opened up the blockbusters. And again, I know the Academy wants to pretend that it's not about the money, but listen, when something is as popular as that, when it's doing as many things in a new way, remixing serials, presenting this fairy tale in space, playing with the anxieties and concerns of the young generation that's coming up in this Vietnam, you know, post-1960s world, I think it's got to be Star Wars. Well, that's 77. And then lastly, and this one hurts because I'm caught between two great loves of mine. On the one hand, I have my love for Paul Newman, because boy, that guy what an actor. He's just the complete package. And then you pair him opposite Robert Redford in The Sting, and that movie is just almost perfect all the way through. Just the atmosphere, the setting, the character work, the big payoff, the score at the end. I love a con movie. It's just so exciting. But on the other hand, there is my great love for the Catholic Church. And, you know, I have to give it to The Exorcist in the 1973 season. I mean, again, that movie, I think, over time has had much more cultural staying power and has done a lot for the horror genre, you know, for things like Get Out. I think Get Out has a lot that it owes to The Exorcist for its use of imagery and the slow burn aspect of it, the use of music and mood and lighting and all the rest. The Sting, again, almost perfect movie, but I think in terms of best picture that year, The Exorcist did more, had a bigger cultural impact. Again, the Academy doesn't like to reward horror movies. They want to pretend they're above it all. They're about art, but there are certain stories that are well suited to cinema. And these horror movies do things and provoke responses and ask questions that movies like The English Patient or Kramer versus Kramer aren't asking. And I think it's worthwhile to hold those up for a little more recognition. Now, of course, most of the movies that I've named have very obviously done quite well for themselves. They have not suffered for being snubbed at the Oscars.
No.
But, you know, just a little extra shine on that mountain of gold that Star Wars has made. You know, it's not going to hurt anything.
Correct. I agree with you there. All right. Thank you for that list. Do you want to tell people where they can find you?
You can find me on my website. That's Father David Mowry, F-A-T-H-E-R, David MOWRY.com. I have there a listing of all the various Movies by Minutes shows that I have been on. And so I was, you know, talking about some of the ordinariness of this scene. You know, no great superhero salvation here. But if you want to hear me talk about superheroes, I've been on the Marvel Movie Minute show talking about Iron Man and Captain America and Thor and the Avengers. So if you want something more than just jumping off a bridge and jumping into heroic action, you can listen to those minutes there.
All right, great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.